third, third and last session of today, and we're going to be looking at the interconnection between energy policy and data science. So a little bit different from the previous two sessions today, and picking up something of what was described at the beginning in the keynote part of today's talk, the keynote talk by as the social science of data pillar. So, just as way of introduction, my name is Rupert Woolmuth, and I head up the energy team at the Government Office for Science. If you don't know the Government Office for Science, we are the office of the Government Chief Scientific Advisor. We work in the middle of government. We're not part of any particular government department, so we're slightly independent from policy. And our role is to make sure that policymaking across government is informed by the very best science and engineering evidence. And so we work very closely with the science and engineering experts in each department, like Ian here, and we do a lot of liaison across Whitehall and also between Whitehall and academia and industry. So the speakers we've got today, we've got three speakers on the panel, and they're going to be taking us through a little bit of the journey today. We've got Rosie McGlynn, who will be starting off telling us a lot about some of the opportunities that data science presents, particularly to the energy consumer, and the huge opportunities there. And then after that, we've got Martin Crouch from Ofgem, who will be talking about a slightly more cautionary perspective, also talking about the opportunities, but also areas where data perhaps has not been used to its fullest advantage, and also areas where there are concerns over privacy and ethics. And lastly, we've got Ian Llewellyn from DEC, who will be wrapping everything up in the policy section by looking at it from the government perspective and how data can help a government department meet its objectives, particularly in terms of security, supply, affordability and sustainability. So I will start off by welcoming Rosie McGlynn from Energy UK. She's Director of New Energy Services, and she is responsible for Energy UK's smart metering programme, demand side response, and storage strategy and delivery.
Thank you, Rupert. So in terms of the programme, yeah, in front of you, Audrey Gallagher was going to be here to talk through some of the more consumer-facing aspects of smart data. She's not here today, but I am, and I'll talk you through effectively the opportunities that come out of the GB Smart Metering Rollout Programme. So I'll explain at a high level effectively some of the stats behind it and the benefits to consumers and the sector. I'll also touch on IoT, so Internet of Things. And I was one of the most vocal questioners earlier, so I'm happy to take questions during my presentation or afterwards. So the smart metering rollout in Britain, it's a rollout that has some big numbers associated with it. So it is a supplier-led rollout. So in comparison to European member states and also rollouts in the US, GB is a supplier-led smart metering rollout. What that means is that the retail business is rolling out and installing the smart meters. Across Europe, it's been the DSO that's carried out that function. And in the US, it's been the integrated utility. So in GB, it's the smart meter, it's the supplier, so British Gas, EDF, OVO, etc., that will be rolling out smart meters. There'll be approximately 53 million meter exchanges. The GB rollout is dual fuel, so it's electricity and gas. So our stats get a bit confusing. We talk about 26 million households, 2 million small businesses, 53 million meter exchanges. So there's lots of numbers associated with this, but actually the reason why we're doing the smart metering rollout in Britain, one of the reasons is the European Energy Efficiency Directive, which basically mandated that where there is a cost benefit positive case to do so, suppliers or that the member state should roll out smart meters to 80% of households by the end of 2020. So there was a policy and regulatory driver from Europe that meant that decision was made to roll out smart metering in Britain. And the targets we're going for are higher than most European member states. So we're going for a supplier license that says that suppliers must take all reasonable steps to roll out smart meters to all GB households. So really we're targeting a higher percentage than our European cousins. In terms of the infrastructure needed to roll out smart meters, a new regulated entity has been created, the Smart Data and Communication Company. And the Smart Data and Communication Company, the Smart DCC, is a new regulated entity licensed by Martin and his colleagues at Ofgem, and their role is to basically bring together data and communication services. So you've got a wide area network service in Scotland that's long-range radio provided by Arqiva, and the rest of GB, it is a 2 and 3G service provided by Telefonica. So we have existing telecoms infrastructure being upgraded for smart in England and Wales, and then in the north of Scotland we have brand new radio infrastructure coming in, long-range radio provided by Arqiva. And the smart DCC effectively acts as the knitting in between suppliers and distribution network operators and authorised third parties and smart metering end devices in consumers' homes. So the GB smart metering rollout has brand new technology, brand new meters, it has suppliers rolling it out, and it has a very tight timeline. So it's a very challenging infrastructure programme that's being delivered as we speak. But the reason that smart metering is a very positive thing for Britain is that effectively it will enable a step change in customer service. So it takes the energy relationship between a customer and their supplier from being a passive and reactive one to a positive and proactive one. So smart meters provide real-time access to energy consumption cost in the customer's home. So every household will be offered an in-home display, which will give them real-time access to data about their gas and electricity usage in pounds and pence and kilowatt hours if they want to look at it that way. But the key primary bit of useful information is the financial piece of information, because it actually gives customers the information they need to start to make better choices about tariffs and services. So the benefits associated with smart metering are really around improved customer service, improved debt management for suppliers, improving energy literacy, taking away bill shock, improving switching, and really empowering customers to start to engage and understand how much their household appliances are using, so they can use their in-home display, start to work out how much the Xbox costs, if I could say probably Xbox, that's right, isn't it, Xbox, I don't know, hair straighteners, whatever. So effectively, all the kind of gadgets in your household that you don't really know how much they're costing you, a smart meter and the in-home display and other analytics will help you to understand how much you're using. Just one thing I wanted to talk to you about from a technology point of view that's kind of positive outreach to customers who are blind or partially sighted. An in-home display, the standard in-home display, is a visual device. It doesn't have anything in terms of auditory support, so it doesn't have text to speech. So for those customers who are blind or partially sighted, a standard in-home display won't help them. So Energy UK, together with the RNIB and our partner Geo, are developing the world's first accessible in-home display. So it will talk and it will have tactile buttons on it. And the reason that we're doing this is that it's really important that all consumers and all members of the public within Britain are able to benefit from smart metering. And it's important that we don't exclude, you know, a fairly large percentage of the UK consumer base from the benefits of smart. So IoT, so we haven't really heard much about the Internet of Things today, I don't think. So in terms of the Internet of Things or the Internet of Energy or the Internet of Everything, the IoT just kind of seems to get bigger and bigger. I think from a Energy UK perspective, we see the Internet of Things kind of just being a, you know, a large disruptive force in the energy sector, but also other sectors well beyond energy. Thinking about the challenges for the UK and IoT, there will be challenges around data privacy and security. So thinking about companies like Nest, so I mean, just as a quick one, who here has a Nest thermostat or a Hive heating system? I've got a Hive. Pete's got, you got a Nest or a Hive?
Nest.
You got a Nest? Okay, so I've got a Hive, he's got a Nest. Anybody else, anyone got a Fitbit? Or a smart Apple Watch? No? Okay. Yeah, good, okay. So in terms of the companies that provide Fitbits, that provide Nest smart thermostats, that provide Hive smart thermostats and other connected devices in your home, the actual kind of data framework around IoT and connected technology isn't that clear as yet. So in terms of the information that Google are collecting in terms of your usage, Peter. I'm not sure how much access you get to in terms of like, your dashboard.
Yeah, there's a dashboard, but mainly you see it on the monitor.
So. Yeah. So in terms of things like smart thermostats, you know, Google are collecting a lot of information about how Peter heats his home and how he zones his home. And the company that provide Hive are doing the same thing with me. And Fitbit will be collecting information on, you know, my walking patterns. And so these companies are actually collecting a lot of information about our day-to-day lives. And the data framework around that isn't particularly clear. The data protocols that Nest utilize are proprietary, and they don't provide open APIs to them as yet to other sectors. So actually, in terms of the information that's being collected about the way that individuals heat their homes, the way they live their lives, a lot of that data is incredibly valuable in terms of other services that Google could offer and email Peter, or, you know, Hive could email me about, or Fitbit could email me about. And the actual sort of data protection framework around IoT isn't that clear. And also the security standards as well, and working out, you know, is that data fully encrypted, and can my smart thermostat be hacked? So the data security and privacy issues around the products that we go and buy from John Lewis or from Maplin or from B&Q, it isn't actually that clear in terms of the terms and conditions and how that's all sort of set out. Whereas from a smart metering perspective, just taking a step back into smart, it's very clear that, you know, the customer's data from their smart meter is their data. So there are regulations already set out in license that make it very clear that if a supplier wants to access a customer's half hourly data, the customer must give their consent. So it's very clear that from a data protection framework perspective in Britain, we've made some very clear choices around who owns the data. So smart metering data, the choices around the granularity of that, it sits with the customer. And also in terms of the install process as well. So thinking about somebody coming into your home, the energy sector had a huge amount of mis-selling issues maybe sort of 5-6 years ago, where lots of customers were being effectively mis-sold energy savings or were getting switched without their consent. And so it was a very clear decision by government and the industry that as part of the smart install process, there would be no sales. So the smart install is all about giving the customer information on how to use their in-home display, give them some basic energy efficiency tips, but we don't go anywhere near tariffs. Because it's really important that you don't effectively create a risk of mis-selling during the install process. Because effectively, to actually get through the door of 26 million households, suppliers need to have the confidence of the customer. So it's really important for the GB rollout that the data framework has been embedded in license. It's very clear there is no selling during the install process. And also that we have a framework in place to deal with any issues that could happen as part of the install. So moving towards closing now. In terms of kind of the opportunities that data around smart metering, smart appliances provide, there are huge opportunities in terms of things like connected healthcare. So if you introduce something like a sensor that collects the temperature of a home, the humidity of a home, it links up with some smart metering data, you quite quickly create a useful data source for connected health in terms of the elderly. If you add a motion detector, you create an additional value add in terms of potentially a healthcare provider who wants to keep someone with Alzheimer's in their home. So there are some very powerful opportunities that come out of using some quite low-cost technology in terms of sensors, integrating it with smart metering data, and then data around the humidity of the home, the temperature of the home. If you package it up, you actually could use as a service, and there are a number of companies already developing this now. So Toshiba are developing this right now in the UK, and they're working with a number of retailers and the Department of Health, just thinking about how to use some quite simple data points to determine whether some simple quick measures could be taken to make a household warmer and more secure, but also to start to reduce the overall NHS costs. I think that's quite interesting. I'm not sure if anybody here is aware of the work that Toshiba are doing. They're doing quite a lot in the connected health space. And that's an area where kind of, I suppose, the data science element, thinking about modeling, you know, a few examples of that, it would be quite simple to start to build a really strong business case up for local healthcare providers. I suppose the final element of this is around working with policymakers and regulators. It's really important that the energy companies are able to innovate and work with the information they already have and then partner with others in order to develop new products and services, but also to have support from the regulators to think about removing data sharing barriers. So there is a current obstruction to effective working between network companies and energy suppliers around making data available in relation to areas where there is a defect on the network. So something that's stopping a smart install happening. At the moment, the RIIO price control is set up, so it's a reactive set of measures. So a supplier goes out, they try and put a meter in, they can't because of the network issue. They then send a message to the network company, and then within 30 days, the network might be able to go out and fix it, potentially, but we don't know. And so there are then the network company, if they can fix it, will let the supplier know, and the supplier will go back. So that customer will have, at a minimum, 3 interactions. Whereas if you had proactive data sharing, where we could look at hotspots on the network, identify where the problems were, the network companies could go out and fix them, and then the suppliers could go out and install and just do a right first time install. And at the moment, the regulatory framework we have is preventing that working. So the key ask from Martin would be a bit of help in terms of looking at the RIIO price control around network defect management. And that's it. Mm-hmm.
I will introduce our second speaker today, Martin Crouch, who is a senior partner at Ofgem. He is responsible for improving regulation and is head of profession for economists in Ofgem. His current responsibilities include oversight of Ofgem's enforcement team and supporting Ofgem's regulatory policy development. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rupert, and thanks for inviting me today. I've now been teed up several times with several different things that I guess I need to cover off, but I'll try to do my best. And maybe one of them actually is being in my dim and distant past an economist and remembering lectures where I was told endlessly about the perils of data mining. Somehow we need to turn that around into getting the value out of the data. I think there is something in the conversation that was had at the back end of the last panel around not losing sight of the models as we try to be more empirical. But maybe we can come back to some of that in terms of how we take this forward. Many of you, I'm sure, will be aware of Ofgem, but just very briefly. So we're the regulator of the electricity and onshore gas markets and networks in Great Britain. We have our primary objective is to look after the interests of energy consumers. So I'll try and talk a bit about consumers in what I say. We do that by overseeing some of the rules for the energy markets. Others are overseen by DEC, so that's a nice segue into the next speaker. We regulate the network businesses, which doesn't mean we tell them what to do. We set some rules that they need to comply with, some incentives. We don't tell them not to talk to other companies in the sector. So some of this is about commercial incentives as well, and companies doing things which are good for their consumers rather than waiting to be told by the regulator what to do all the time. We also, as part of that, we fund innovation spend by the network companies to try and get them to trial new methods. And we've been very keen in that to push for transparency in what they find, which hopefully will have some read across and play out in techniques that are taken up in the sectors. I think we see that innovation mechanism as being successful so far, but it needs to go a lot further. We also look at the standards of service that the companies deliver, and again, that's an area where, with my enforcement hat on, I'll talk a bit about some of the lessons there. One of the new areas that we've just had a bit of a reorganisation, which is why I'm doing the job I'm doing now, one of the things I'm looking at is horizon scanning. So some of the things that have been talked about today, and really we've just touched on the more obvious ones. I think there's a lot of potential development in the energy sector over the next few years, which we're just launching a project this week actually to try and set out some of the ideas about what might happen, some of the learning from most organisations, Energy UK included, National Grid, DEC, doing their own projections, pathways out to 2030, projection scenarios for 2030. There are now more than a dozen of those. If you look across organisations in the energy sector, we're not going to do another one, because that seems a bit pointless. But try and draw the lessons from some of those that have happened and think about the implications for energy consumers and for how we regulate. So that includes, for example, that if we look at the cost reduction that we've seen in solar PV and batteries, that's sort of 15 to 20% a year cost reductions. If that carries on for another 5 years, another 10 years, we will be in a completely different world to the world which you've been talking about for the rest of for earlier today. That is just a dramatic change in the way in which we will be running our electricity sector. It still doesn't necessarily allow us to electrify all of heat and transport, so it doesn't deal with the energy sector challenges we've got. But trying to think about how we do make those changes in the heat and transport sectors will be really important for the both for the future use of gas networks, future use of electricity networks, some of the scare stories that were talked about of going off grid and therefore never needing to pay for the transmission network, I think are, well, if they do ever happen here, they'll have happened in lots of other places first, because the economic drivers for them, the net metering type solutions are much more prevalent in other places. So we've got plenty of chance to learn from where it does happen first. But there's fundamental changes possible, I think, in the energy sector. We could, in 10 years' time, see sufficient disintermediation of the sector that things like suppliers don't really exist anymore, let alone, you know, the sorts of companies that are in the market today. So trying to think about what some of those changes might be, what the signals, the leading signals for some of those drivers are, that's what we'll be working on in our horizon scanning work. I thought it's worth just giving a few examples of where we see challenges with data already. So this is not necessarily big data, but sort of medium-sized data in some cases, or small data, even where silos, use of the data gets in the way. Someone mentioned earlier, one of the challenges we've had over the last couple of years has been a big take-up, somewhat to people's surprise, of PV panels, largely spread across the country, but a lot of them, for example, in the southwest of England. In 2012, there were projections made by National Grid, by consultants for DEC, by others, that by 2030 we'd have 8 gigawatts of PV. That was a projection made in 2012. We passed that last year. So what was expected to take 18 years took 3. So how do we cope with that? One of the challenges was for the networks who fairly soon found they couldn't install any more generation in their area. It was full up because of all this unexpected development. The local network company and National Grid both said, well, but the trouble is we don't really know where this PV is. No one's told us about it. And it's not on our systems, as was mentioned earlier. And the network companies are pretty good now, I think, at optimizing their own systems. What they didn't quite think to do was to wonder who might have this data. You know, these PV panels we are paying feed-in tariffs to. Someone knows who to pay. It's not like no one knows where they are and they're completely off the system. They are being paid subsidies. And it turned out that when we looked at this issue, we scratched our heads a bit and we thought, actually, we have the data. So our ESERV system, our ESERV organisation that oversees the feed-in tariffs, had the data as to where the PV panels were fitted. The network companies hadn't thought to ask us, and it probably did take us a few more days than it should have to join the dots, but we then found we couldn't give them the data. It was covered by the addresses of the people who had the panels, covered by data protection. We got around it in that case by using less granular data, so in effect it was anonymised, because they didn't really need to know exactly which roads they were in, they just needed to know which areas they were in. That's allowed them to spend a bit less money on freeing up their networks than they would otherwise have done to connect new generation, because for good reason they were being conservative because they didn't really know what was there. So once they knew a bit more what was there, they could be less conservative. So the silos in the system, the lack of open access to data, and this is For PV, it's, there's now about 700,000 homes, I think, with buildings with PV panels, so it's not a huge data set, but it's 700,000 addresses that you know, just the right people didn't have access to the information, weren't able to build it into their models with sufficient confidence. We've been running a few enforcement cases recently. A lot of them have looked at challenges with the suppliers dealing with complaints particularly well. So in one recent case where we decided actually not to open a case because the supplier was getting on top of things, we waited a couple of months to get the last quarter's complaints data. So this is data from October to December. We had to wait until February to get the data to see if the supplier was actually getting on top of complaints and dealing with them, or whether we needed to open an investigation. We should be in a system where we can know what the complaints were yesterday, not what complaints were back in October when we get to February. You know, we can get data on some customers by looking at what's coming across on social media. That's a good way of informing who's complaining and moaning about their energy suppliers. Tells you quite a lot, tells you in real time pretty much. Some of the organisations that get complaints data do have systems where they know the next day, you know, what complaints they had the day before. We're just not quite joined up enough in how we use this. And in the world that we're talking about with smart data, where we've, you know, that's in areas where we're not talking about huge volumes of data, we're just talking about institutional challenges. Once the amount of data that's available explodes with smart metering and smart grids, if we don't manage to address some of those institutional challenges before we get there, I suspect they'll be a lot harder when we do get to that scale. There's lots of interesting opportunities with making use of those data, as Rosie was saying, for other purposes. You know, the idea that if my mum doesn't switch a kettle on in the morning, I'll get a text message is something that's actually perfectly plausible. Whether my mum would be keen about that is a whole other story. And that's the other angle on this, is just how far people are worried about privacy and data protection. I think we saw the Competition and Markets Authority, which just done a big study of the energy markets, came out with provisional findings 2 weeks ago. One of the things they said was they'd like Ofgem to hold a database of all customers that are still on standard tariffs. Anyone here on standard tariff with their energy supplier and knows it? You don't know it, that's the problem. If you are, then switch, because even with the same supplier, you'll get a much better deal. So we're likely to be required to have a database of those people, and then give access to energy suppliers to send them marketing information. That's going to make us really popular. It's a real challenge, I think, for how we can engage customers more, but in a way which has their support and their consent. And if that's only over one piece of database, when, as Rosie pointed out again, you know, those same customers are probably giving vast amounts more data to Google or to Apple or whoever it is. But those companies, for some reason, they sort of trust, and the energy suppliers, not so much. We're also being asked to do, to oversee random control trials with new ways of engaging with customers, new billing, being able to actually understand and differentiate between what works in different trials, different combinations of measures, again, is an area where I think there will be more data available, and how we do that, how we work with people outside our organisation. We're very much open to partnering with academic institutions or others on working through some of this to try and get the best information we can to drive our policy. So none of that is particularly around the challenges with big data. It's just how we use the data that is available and break down some of the barriers that we've built up within in the industry. But how we do it in a way which doesn't then raise the spectre of Big Brother, you know, telling people what to do, monitoring their every move. Because when we start down that road, as we've said several times on smart metering, if the first few experiences are bad, that will have a much more damaging impact than if the last few experiences are bad. So it's about how we can move into this in the right way. So some of those challenges I think we see today, and hopefully we can get in a better place once the increases in data become available.
I love that example of the solar panels in the southwest, because why that's such a good example is you've got data in another part of your organisation, it costs nothing for you to access, just a little bit of staff time to do the disaggregation of that data, and then you can save network operators money. But then it raises the challenges of privacy and the other aspects of how that data is used. And these are kind of some of the questions I think the Alan Turing Institute will really be able to address, these social science questions of data. How best we can use data for society, but not in infringing areas of privacy and other ethical questions. So fantastically good example. And I think energy provides a very good kind of microcosm of those type of questions. So our third speaker this afternoon is Ian Llewellyn, who is Acting Deputy Head of Engineering at the Department of Energy and Climate Change, and he leads a team of engineers in DEC that supply advice to ministers and his policy colleagues, which cover the whole range of energy policy technology and energy technologies. And I must say that DEC has probably one of the best, finest teams of engineers of any government department. And I think it's a good example of many other departments that have such good advice. So thanks very much, Ian.
Good afternoon. I'm going to probably repeat some of what you've heard before. Well, I'm not going to apologise for that because it's important stuff. It's how DEC sees the world as well. I'll also point out this is an excellent time for the Alan Turing Institute to run such an event, because as we just heard, the Competitions and Mergers Agency come up with a report that says that we should be using data more cleverly in order to make the system more competitive. We've also had a National Infrastructure Commission report which has said that if we use data better, we could save billions per pounds of investment in the energy systems. Some of you may have seen in the very small print for the budget, way below the bits about all benefit cuts, that we've actually just got an extra 50 million from the Treasury to look at data analysis and smart systems for meeting our decarbonisation targets. And finally, in May, we're going to run a call for evidence on smart grid and data. Which means in May you could all write in and tell us what were your best ideas of how we could use data in order to meet our targets. Talking about which, these are our targets, these are the DEC's mission, this is what government wants us to do. Primary objective is energy security. The government definitely wants us to keep the lights on. So anything we do that's liable to risk that is very much off the agenda. We have got targets on climate change, direct targets, just set by the Climate Change Committee, and they've just published their fifth carbon budget. The whole objective is by 2050 we have an 80% reduction in the amount of carbon dioxide we emit in the UK. In addition to that, we have got, courtesy of the EU, a renewable energy target, which means by 2020 we've got to have 15% of our total energy provided by renewable sources. And that's energy, not electricity. And lastly is affordability. I think lastly but not least is affordability. Of course, affordability depends who you are. If you're a pensioner spending a lot of their income on your energy bill, you are worried about even small increases in prices, and you probably don't have the sort of money to spend on a lot of sensors and other smart devices around your home. If you're the government, what you really want to do is get to the stage where renewable energy sources can compete effectively against coal and gas, especially gas. And even nuclear. But we believe, as a lot of people do, and I think a lot of people in this room, that the use of data can make achieving these targets easier. So that is what the UK electricity system currently looks like. We have a top to bottom system, if you like. So we have generators supplying power to the national grid, which goes down and supply energy to large industrial, commercial and domestic customers. Increasingly, we have distributed generation located on the low voltage side, so connected to the DNO operators network and not the national grid. And increasingly, we're having domestic customers putting their own generation on things like photovoltaic panels. Now, this is the situation when the electricity industry was privatised way back, I think it was 1989, and there's virtually no data collection on the system at all. The people in the generators were, the generators and the grid were all run by the same organisation, so there wasn't really much point in actually collecting very much data to take that forward. But since privatisation, we've now started to get many more metering points on the network, especially on the high voltage side. So we have all generators in order to connect up to the system, as the generators are owned by a different company, the National Grid now, and have to have a metering point. National Grid meter at the exit to their network as well, and all distributed generators have to have a metering point as well. So there's already quite a lot of data that's actually being produced and being sent to Alexon. And you can download that, by the way, you've got to go to Alexon sites and become a registered user. But increasingly, we're going to see more metering on the DNO side at the low voltage transformer. And increasingly, as we're installing all these smart meters you just heard about, we're going to get metered data at every premises. So in the next 10 years, this is going to be a very well metered system. The question is what we actually do with that data. Okay. Now, in addition to that, there is a big technology move to install more sensors in the house. Increasingly, we are seeing people with their photovoltaic panels having export meters, and we've also got attached to that a lot of what we might call Internet of Things applications. So, for example, room thermostats, wall-mounted transmitters for amplifying signals, control units, motion detectors. All of this data, if the consumer agrees, you can access for some sort of useful service to consumers. This I've taken straight from the National Infrastructure Commission report. It makes a very important point that the costs of our electricity system is determined by the peak capacity, not the average capacity. So we put as much distribution and transmission network there, we put as much generation to meet the peak demand, which is roughly around 55 gigawatts, which only occurs in January, generally between the hours of 5 to 8 in the evening. That is very inefficient. So if we can actually move some of that, move some of the peak away to the less crowded area of the graph, then we get a benefit. And that's what Yaf was talking about earlier from KiwiPower. And we recognise that is a good way forward. And we would like to see more of that. The question is how we see more of that. Now, the reason we think it's important is because going forward, we are thinking about electrifying more of the UK's infrastructure. For example, you would all presumably be going onto electric vehicles in order to meet our 2050 target. In addition, there would have to be much more electric heating in order to meet that 80% reduction target. That could potentially increase the peak demand by a factor of 2. So we've got two choices at DEC. We can either build lots more generation stations lots more transmission networks, a lot more distribution networks in order to meet that. Alternatively, we could move to more of the sorts of smart technology, the more demand side response stuff, and hopefully decrease the cost of actually meeting our targets. Okay, so here is a vision document. Right, in the garage you've got an electric vehicle. Your electric vehicle uses data from the network to know when to charge. It also possibly, at times of peak demand, if its battery is full, it uses that battery to supply power back into the network. All perfectly possible. We have smart meters in there, of course, which is going to give you all the necessary tariff information to make the correct decisions. You have got smart appliances, which will run when you want them, when the energy system wants them to run, as opposed to necessary when you want them to run, as now. And you have things like smart fridges, which automatically adjust their power consumption to achieve a frequency compensation to the network. And you have smart heating controls that, again, optimize your bill for you using some sort of smart agent. So that's the vision. The question is how you actually achieve that at an acceptable cost, maintaining the privacy of the customer. If you look at the local area, we have additional things we think are going to come in. We have batteries, which are, as I think Logan described, the price of batteries is on an exponential decreasing curve. So we think in about 5 years, they're going to be perfectly cost-effective, either in the distribution network or inside people's homes. You've got much more local generation coming on stream. So eventually, the national grid might be there just to actually provide top-up power. And as we've heard earlier, that can lead problems about who actually pays for the national grid. Is not going to be used continuously. But the important thing is that all of this requires data in order to work effectively. And how you actually make it work effectively is still an open question, which hopefully this institute will be able to give us some answers for. If you look at some other examples of where we can use data in order to meet our energy targets, intelligent thermostats have been mentioned. We've already done trials on those, and we know that thermostats which have a proximity detector, so they know when you're in and out, on average save about 10% of your heating bill, which is an enormous amount. I mean, that's probably around twice what you would save if you installed cavity insulation in your home. And you can do that at a very much smaller cost than you can with cavity insulation. The theory of that is, how do you know what is a smart thermostat? People who make zonal systems, I don't know anyone's, we have little hands up who's got what heating system. Has anyone got an EVA home heating system? Heat control? Absolutely not. Not surprised, because they cost £1,500. But they control the heating individually in all the rooms of your house. So when you walk into your living room, it automatically turns on the heating in your living room for you. And when you walk out, it turns it off. They use data analytics in order to work out what your behaviour is. So they would know, for example, that you go to bed at 10 o'clock at night. Very neat system, very expensive, but it saves about twice as much energy. Can people think of a way of using data analytics with less sensors to make that happen? If they can, this is a good time to tell me the answer. Peer-to-peer trading. Currently, if you've got a solar PV on your roof, we will give you roughly 5p now for every kilowatt hour of electricity you produce under FITs. We also, every kilowatt you export, you get roughly 2p. Now, down the road from you, there'll be somebody who's trying to buy electricity, and they would be paying for about 15p. So why can't you export your electricity from your solar panel when you don't want it to the next door neighbour or the neighbour down the road? And there are people in the States that have developed data systems that will actually do this. And they're secure and they work in similar ways, sort of the bootcamp coin sort of system. But is that something that we could do in the UK? If we did that and the buyer agrees to buy at 10p and the seller agrees to sell at 10p, then both the buyer and the seller make money out of it. Intelligent vehicles, smart storage, I've sort of covered. Intelligent vehicles, most of what I've talked today is all about the electricity network. Most of what I say also applies to the gas network to some degree. But there's also the one third of our energy use which goes into vehicles, which we've got to try and sort of decrease somehow. And there's a variety of different data analytic techniques that could be used to optimize engines. And again, tests demonstrate that if you have a suitable intelligent system, you can save 20% of fuel in a vehicle. So it's not just electricity networks or gas networks. There are other things we can do as well. But the real interesting thing for me is advice and information. We, under the Green Deal when it was running, we could send out somebody who had a couple of months training in energy, and they would give you independent advice on how to make your house better insulated. Why can't we do that automatically? Why can't we take data from all these sensors, compare it to the average house like yours, and actually give you independent advice over your mobile phone and whether it's right for you to install more loft insulation, for example? They're all pretty good things, you know, that could make our targets much easier to achieve. But I will point out there is one major risk, and that is the less tech-savvy, the fuel-poor customer might not benefit to the same degree as all the others. And it might end up that you're saving energy for the rich and the middle classes, not for the poor, in which case they take much more of the cost of maintaining the system. It's all really a question of cost. Just in case you think we're interested in this just for our own benefit, and we asked Pike Research to come up with the rate of growth in this data analytics smart energy system, and they worked out total growth over the world per year was about 12%, breaking down into those figures there. Oops, sorry. So this is a very big business opportunity for the UK as well, which is another reason why the charts have decided to give us another 50 million to actually look at this in the budget. There are some barriers. I think most of these have been mentioned. There are still some hardware challenges. Currently, there is no real-time dynamic pricing. That is something that Ofgem are looking into. They can provide customers who want it with dynamic pricing. There's a lack of standards. So getting things to work together needs a PhD in electronics. And there are concerns about safety and privacy. So already mentioned today. Finally, I'd like to just point out that it's not just about the technology, it's about the user as well. And you're going to give the user all this fancy equipment, you're going to give them the benefit of running apps, some smart software which will optimize their bill, but there'll be downsides to this. The consumer is currently just completely passive. If they want their washing done, they put it in the washing machine, they press a button, and out comes the washing. If you're using systems where you've got time of use tariffs, and you're trying to use that washing machine to balance the network, they will have to accept that they won't be able to do their washing immediately. They will have to wait, and they'll put in, instead of putting in and just starting the machine, they will say, I might have waited 6 hours and the washing machine decides when to do it. There could be considerable opposition to this unless we bring the consumer along with us. So I would suggest that it's not just the technology you have to worry about, but it's also the people who are going to use it as well. And that's it. Thank you very much.